So my name is Kelly Potter. I'm a professor of philosophy at Utah Valley University. And I do research in the philosophy of religion and also the philosophy of gender and logic as well. And that's the stuff I teach, science and gender, stuff like that. And I have done a lot of stuff on Mormon theology, mostly. A little bit of what you might call more Mormon studies stuff, but mostly Mormon theology, kind of taking an analytic theology approach to doing theology.
Could you explain what an analytic approach is?
Oh, yeah. So it's sort of the kind of theology that's done by people who are analytic philosophers. And analytic philosophers pay attention to arguments a lot, the logic of arguments, the kind of language being used. They pay attention, they want to, you know, make sure to define their terms carefully and clearly and so on. So that's what I'm referring to, is the application of the tools of analytic philosophy to doing theology. So yeah, I wrote probably a dozen articles.
This was in Element and other places?
Yeah, in Element. I was actually the founding editor of Element for its first online edition, and then we went to
print only?
Print, yeah, and online. It was going to be print and online,
okay.
But it's the person who was the editor for a long time just wasn't publishing it. So, he just wouldn't get any of the issues done. So anyway, they were having issues. But at some point along the way, while I was doing this academic work on Mormon studies and Mormon theology, I was also at that time a believer, although I would say I was a very, a radical believer, like a liberation theologian type. I was trying to come up with a way of understanding Mormon theology from a liberation theological perspective. You know what liberation theology is.
I need it defined. Sorry.
Oh, okay. So liberation theology is, really, it's a movement. I mean, you could define it more broadly, but it sort of started in the Catholic Church, but the idea is to interpret the Christian tradition from the perspective of the poor. And liberation theologians in Central and South America actually got involved in politics, trying to change the political structures and economic systems in some of the countries there. So, for example, in in the Sandinista Revolution, you had people from the clergy that were actually involved in both the revolution part of it and in the construction of the government afterwards. In fact, I think the minister of culture was a priest, Catholic priest who was a liberation theologian. Oscar Romero, the famous Catholic priest from El Salvador, I think, who was condemning the death squads and all of those murders, was himself, assassinated for being kind of sympathetic to liberation theology. He was sent there by the Catholic Church to get rid of it, by the Vatican, right, to get rid of it, but because he was more moderate in his views, but the more he was in the position of being the bishop in Salvador, the more he was in that, worked in that position, the more he came to agree with liberation theology. Anyway, so the liberation theology in its content deals with interpreting the Christian tradition from the perspective of the poor. And so, for example, they're going to say, salvation involves political liberation, right? And they're going to interpret sin as the collective sin of the system that we have. And grace is coming together as a community and being able to do stuff that none of us can do on our own. The body of Christ works through us, you know, that. So they interpret it in very concrete terms.
Could you repeat that a bit? The sin and grace definition.
Yeah, so sin, according to, well, at least some of the writers in the liberation theological tradition, they're going to say, sin, like, say, original sin. Why is there original sin? Well, there's original sin because we are born into a system that's exploitative, and we're all complicit in it because we all benefit from it. So those of us who benefit from it, you know, we're complicit in that, which means that we're affected by the sin of it. So that's their interpretation of original sin, right? It would be about the material conditions of human life. The fact that there's the haves and the have-nots, and that conflict is, you know, there's some people that are exploiting, you know, the mass majority of people.
Is this
right?
At all conceptually similar to what's at least called critical race theory or BLM stuff, where there's a sense of...
There's some points of contact. Yeah.
With respect to what's the redemptive story being achieved and the sin background.
Yeah, in fact, liberation theology affected black theology and black ministry in the United States, right? James Cone is one of the famous liberation theologians, famous black liberation theologians, worth reading if you want to get kind of a black perspective on it. But it started in Central and South America, at least as far as I understand. I think there might have been some European liberation theologians earlier, and there have always been Christians in the Christian tradition who have argued for radical political transformation, right, as part of the Christian tradition. Are you out of battery?
No, we're good.
Okay.
Making sure the audio is getting picked up. Might move in a little bit.
Yeah. So I was trying to apply that to Mormonism in some of my work. But at some point, you see, I'm a trans woman, and I was in the closet. And at some point, that conflict became paramount. And due to that and other personal stuff that was going on, I ended up leaving Mormonism. At first, I was still a Christian. But I even lost that belief after a while.
You retained some, like, death, burial, resurrection beliefs?
No, not literalistically. Not a Christian like John Dominic Crossan is a Christian, not like typical evangelicals are, right? Yeah, I did have that sort of belief, the really literalistic belief, before I hit my adulthood, but when I became an adult and went on my mission, it became what we called at the time a liberal Mormon, somebody who's like, you know, in the liberal Protestant tradition, right? That type of, and so I believed in some of it literally, but most of it not literally. But I lost even the last bit of literal belief that I had in an afterlife and in a good God. I could believe in Spinoza's God, you know, the God that is just nature, right? But I couldn't believe in any kind of deity that is anthropomorphic in some sense,
personal,
like, and cares about us, and in other words, the typical belief in God that you get in most Christian groups, I couldn't accept.
You mean classic theism?
Yeah, classic theism, but even other stuff too. I mean, if I were to be a theist, I'd probably be a process theist at this point.
Could you define that?
Process theology is an approach to theology to the concept of God in particular, but there's more to it than this. It's an approach to the concept of God that has God. It's kind of like open theism, but more radical than open theism, because God can only act by persuasion, not by coercion. And as a result, omnipotence is totally denied. In fact, they argue that omnipotence is incoherent, doesn't actually make sense. God is love, and they take that really, I don't know, kind of literally, because it's like God can only influence by loving, and the creation isn't done, that kind of stuff. If I were to go back into, you know, and start becoming a practicing Christian, my concept of God would probably be that. And I would, of course, see Jesus and Jesus' life in the way that, like, the Jesus Seminar does, and definitely not in the way that evangelicals do, right? Yeah. I mean, and that's the kind of Mormon I was. I wasn't one of those Mormons that was doing apologetics.
I do remember you being very passionate in the community, presenting in a very enthusiastic, cheerful, just forceful in the sense that of existential, maybe?
Yeah, I've always been that way, yeah. What did I talk on? What was the... Do you remember?
Oh, man. I remember the last talk I heard you give was on postmodernism, maybe? Related to post... Or maybe he was accused of sharing sensibilities with postmodernism. And I remember Blake Osler complaining that maybe that would undermine a view of justice. Apologies for the ambiguity. I forget.
Yeah, no, I don't remember that. Yeah, so you know, being trans isn't something that's compatible with being in the LDS Church. It's that easy. For a while, people who were queer and trans in the church thought, okay, maybe.
So practically, there are. It seems like there's some people that are trans that are still in the LDS Church and they're still attending. But for you to be LDS means more than that?
Yeah. I mean, they have like a secondary status. They can't. They have the same status that blacks did before 1978, right? Meaning that they can go to church. It's like, you can go to church and you can do that kind of stuff, but you're probably not going to have a calling, and definitely no temple recommend. Yeah, so, and that, for a lot of Mormons, the temple's the big thing. For me, it never was, so I never cared whether I had one or not. When I left, I that's not something, it wasn't about that. It was, it was definitely, I don't know, it was just like an overall kind of change of life. That opened up the possibility for me to come out and, you know, live my authentic self instead of repressing being trans.
Could you talk a little bit about your view of identity and freedom, what it means to be yourself? And there's different, like, philosophies of what even it means to have an identity.
Well, okay, so that's a really big question. I don't know that I can answer that, like, really well quickly. But in terms of just my trans identity, what that means is, I mean, this is just the way I, this is the, well, there's a subjective part, and then there's like a theoretical or objective part. The subjective part is, my experience is that my self-image is female. And I was born, assigned male at birth. And as a result of that, the feeling that I have this self-image of myself being female, it's actually self-image of myself having a female body, not necessarily doing typical female things. It's more focused on the body, the biology, and the way my body actually was, right, because of having testosterone. There's a clash there. It's called gender dysphoria. And that clash causes a lot of mental anguish, and for the longest time, of course, what people tried to do was do reparative therapy or conversion therapy to help trans people just accept who they are, but one doctor at some point was having just too many of his patients commit suicide, so he decided to go ahead and start giving them hormones, and it worked. They wanted hormones, they wanted to make their bodies more feminized. And interestingly, this worked at reducing the suicide rate from over 40% to below 10%. And so the therapy, the clinical world was dragged by the the empirical evidence that they needed to not try to convert trans people, but just accept them in their identity, help them transition. At the same time, you had studies being done on the brains of trans people. One study showed that trans women, their brains in an area near the hypothalamus, their brains matched the cis women, or in other words, non-trans women, not the cis men, like you might expect because of the common biology. And you might say, well, it's because they all went on hormones. But actually, one of the trans brains that was examined, so this is after death, so post-mortem examination, at least one of them, if not several of them, were trans women who never had access to hormones, so they never actually did the physical medical transition, but they just lived as trans women. So essentially what they found, and they replicated the study with another kind of study using more advanced technology just in the last 10 years in the Netherlands. They did this on children that identified as trans. It's more acceptable there. And they just found that that area of the brain is different in kids with gender dysphoria. In other words, trans girls match cis girls. In other words, those who were assigned male at birth, who identify as girls, their brains matched cis girls' brains in the same area. The current theory is that because of the role that hormones play in differentiating the whole body, not just, you know, your primary and secondary sex characteristics, but also the brain, because of the role that hormones play, it's possible for things to get lined up in a different sort of, in a non-binary way, right? Where maybe the body someone ends up with is going to be identified as male by the doctor, but the area of brain that gives them a sense of their own self, that area actually identifies them as female. And that's what I think is going on with, when I say I'm a trans woman and I identify as a woman, that's what I mean, is that I have this experience of contradiction between the way that my brain wants to understand myself and the way that my body is. And that sense of contradiction, dissonance, led me to be suicidal throughout most of my life. I had suicide ideation since I was a teenager, and it was related to this. And at one point I was cognizant of being trans, but it didn't come out because it was so awful at the time. Treatment of trans people was just horrible in the 80s and 90s. And so I lived in the closet for a long time, which was easier because of the fact that although I'm a trans woman, I'm attracted to women. And so if I'm living in the closet, you know, as a trans woman, you know, I can be heterosexual, so to speak. I mean, I wasn't really, but so that conflict, that's the conflict. Really, when it comes down to it, that's what pushed me out of the LDS church. I mean, there's, you know, I could go on about all of the other stuff that causes people to leave, but I knew about all those things before I actually came around to leaving.
Can we talk a little bit about your worldview now? How do you see the world? I asked you earlier before this about truth, correspondence, theory of truth. In what sense is that adopted or not adopted? Any sort of realism? Mm-hmm. And then I actually forget the category for it, but it was the sense of constant conflict or a sense of
contradictions
being an explanatory framework.
Yeah, so I now see, I'm not a theist. I've read a lot of Buddhist philosophy, very specifically Buddhist philosophy, not necessarily Buddhist religion stuff, but mostly just Buddhist philosophy stuff. And I kind of agree with the Four Noble Truths. There's suffering in the world. It's caused by, craving, attachment, And the solution to that is to get rid of attachment, right? And so I agree with the first three noble truths. I don't know about the Eightfold Noble Path, but I do agree with them, except that I want to say, look, when it comes to attachment, sometimes my suffering comes from the other's attachments. So, for example, sometimes the suffering of people in the world is the result of the fact that we have this ruthless capitalist system where some people control a vast amount of wealth. Very few people control a vast amount of wealth, and the vast majority of people on the planet actually, you know, have relatively little. That kind of situation is one where the attachment of some human beings, namely the capitalists, causes suffering for other human beings. And so they could be Buddhists all they want, these poor people, and that's not going to help them, right? Because their suffering's not going to go away. So that's why I'm not fully, I wouldn't call myself a total Buddhist, because I think Marxism has to step in there. Marx and the tradition that Marx is part of, the communist and socialist tradition, which actually started before Marx. Marx is part of that tradition.
Can you give some definition to the Marxism and communism that you told
Yeah.
to?
So, I think Marx understood the nature of how capitalism works, the fact that it's based on class conflict, and that their conflict or contradiction is an important part of how we understand how history proceeds, especially in terms of the contradiction between political and economic forces of different sorts, right? So in capitalism, it's the capitalists and workers and peasants, and those are different classes with different interests, and those interests come into conflict. Capitalism is exploitative based on the profit motive, and as a result, it's not going to be the best system for the greater part of humanity. It's a good system for some people who benefit from it, including a lot of very highly skilled and educated workers in the United States, right? But workers mostly in other places in the world, are exploited. So that's the basics of Marxism is, that history is driven by contradictory forces between economic classes, different economic classes. And we want...
Perpetually without
yeah.
utopia. There's no alternative in sight.
Yeah.
It's only ever going to be that.
There are alternatives, but it's hard to see them. But things will change. Things do change. We've gone through lots of different economic systems. So, for example, we
have... In terms
of
conflict, though, the reality of that conflict is perpetual?
Oh. I think that you can... Okay, so, yeah, at one level it is. There's always going to be opposition in everything. That's a principle that I still believe from Mormonism, right? That's actually a principle in Mormon theology as well. There's going to be an opposition in everything. As a socialist and actually, a communist, so that's the kind of socialist I am, is a communist. I defend the socialist countries like the former Soviet Union, even though there are problems with what happened in the 30s, and also China in particular, which I think is more successful, dramatically more successful than the Soviet Union was. There were problems during the Cultural Revolution, but the difference between those countries and this country is who the ruling class is. And there it's the Communist Party, which represents the interests of the workers. Here it's, the capitalists. Ultimately, they get what they want. They'll get the candidates they want, usually, and when they don't, they'll keep the candidates from being able to do anything, the elected officials from being able to do anything radical or change things in a radical way. And I want to change that, right? So I want to have an economy that is planned, although some market forces, like you see in Vietnam and China, rather than a purely planned state-run economy, the way that Some of the socialist countries have approached it, like Cuba and the Soviet Union. So I believe in market socialism. And of course, the goal is to get to a classless society where the economic differences between people are so nominal that they just don't make that much of a difference, right? So does that make sense? Yeah.
Could you speak a little bit to intersectionality and critical race theory? Those are words that I think a lot of my audience would be interested in, and the categories or definitions, and maybe how that relates to any of this.
Yeah. So, so intersectionality is this idea that Kimberly Crenshaw came up with. It's the idea that, well, actually, let me talk about something before we talk about intersectionality. So, identity politics. So, identity politics arose in the 60s and 70s. And essentially what it was, you know, people in various groups that were dominated or marginalized in some way, they they advocated for themselves and for their group, right? So you get this with, you know, people in the civil rights movement. You get this with people in the gay rights movement, which started around the same time. So they're all advocating for their own groups, their own identity, right? And in particular, in feminism, there were lots of white women in the beginnings of feminism and even later in feminism that were advocating for their views. And these women were, you know, relatively well off, materially speaking. And so their concerns and their interests were really different than really poor women or black women. And so some black women started to point that out to these white feminists. Well, wait, actually, the things that you want to achieve, it wouldn't help us. So, like, being able to get jobs outside the home. Well, we're already working domestic labor, right, for hardly anything. That's how we even can survive. We have to get jobs out of the home. It's not a career. It's like, you know, a job. It's a hard job, and we get paid hardly anything for it, but we have to do it just to survive. That's a totally different kind of issue. Also, white women don't see the ways in which the mass incarceration of the black population, especially the black male population in the United States, has had a negative impact on, women's issues from a black perspective. So in other words, what they wanted to say was this: you can't talk about race independent, or sorry, you can't talk about gender issues and gender oppression independent of race. And you can't do it independent of sexual orientation either, right? For the same reason, there are different concerns. So we started thinking in terms of the intersection of various groups. And the way that you get around in society has to do with the intersection of those groups. So I'm white and I'm a trans woman. I don't face anywhere near the kind of violence that a black trans woman would. Just because my white background, my middle class background, makes it so that I'm gainfully employed, and I live in a suburban area, relatively safe suburban area. I don't have to turn to sex work just to survive, which a lot of trans women of color have to do. Their lives are dangerous. Their life expectancy is in their 30s, right? I do face transphobia, trans ignorance, that kind of stuff, to some extent, but not to the extent that they do. So I can't just talk about trans issues. I have to talk about them as intersecting. So then critical race theory. Most critical race theorists recognize the need for talking about the intersectionality, but I would say that usually when we're talking about that expression, unless we mean it in just the narrow sense that applies to legal theory, and that can't be what everybody's talking about, because that isn't of that much interest, right, outside of law schools. But if you're looking at it in the broader, what that term might mean in a broader sense, it's just the idea that we have to see U.S. history as being shaped fundamentally by race, and it's white supremacy. So it's a kind of a, you know, and then there are certain tools that are used, tools that come from what's called critical theory, which traces back to people like Marx and the Frankfurt School. But it's not just Marxists, right? It's other kinds of theorists, mostly on the left, right? Yeah, in fact, I think you would identify almost all of them as on the left, but they're various different types of left-wing views, like anarchism or Marxism or, you know, democratic socialism or environmental, you know, feminism, you know, just various different kinds of left-wing views. So, critical race theory in that sense would definitely need to be intersectional, because we have to recognize that patriarchy affected the women, the black women who were enslaved, even though slavery was probably the main way that they were oppressed. They were also oppressed by the patriarchy too, and it meant that their lot was worse sometimes than most of the time than the men who were black slaves, right? So
could you tell us what you're working on these days, what projects you have, what's mostly interesting you?
So I have a book that I'm working on. I don't have a publisher yet. It's probably going to be, well, it's about religious heterodoxy and the nature of religious belief. I'm arguing that with regard to religious belief, you can never, in a non-question-begging way, determine the difference between orthodoxy and heterodoxy. Or, in other words, you know, the right belief and some different interpretation, which may or may not be heretical, right? And so I'm arguing that when we understand religious belief, we have to understand it as involving internal disagreements within the religious traditions. So, like, you know, Christianity is a really good example of this, because there are a lot of disagreements. It wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that Catholic theology and evangelical Protestant theology are significantly different in a lot of ways. And that maybe it even gets to the point, at least for some Catholics and some evangelicals, that they don't even have the same concept of God, right? A lot of people would say Mormons don't have the same concept of God as the rest of Christianity. But when you really look at the diversity of concepts of God, you realize, wow, there is really a lot of different concepts here. And I think it's kind of an illusion to think there is such a thing as a unified thing as Christianity. The word makes it sound like you've got a unified group, but really what you have is, a divided group, groups that are arguing about how to interpret their tradition. That, to me, is a really important aspect of religious belief that people don't pay enough attention to. So I'm writing a book arguing that we need to pay attention to it, and then showing how we can go back through some of the philosophical and theological tradition through the framework of that, of heterodoxy. Seeing how religions develop, how religious belief develop, what religious belief is, through this idea that, well, you know, there's always an orthodoxy, there's always a heterodoxy, there's always another way of interpreting, you know, the same text or the same creed, right? Catholics who are totally disagree about the Trinity, like the Latin Trinitarians versus the social Trinitarians, they're both going to say that they accept certain creeds because they have to, right? But they disagree in how to interpret it. So there's no way. We try to pinpoint it. We try to pinpoint orthodoxy. I don't think we can. And I think that has a lot of implications for how we should think about religion, including, like, how we should think about religious liberty, religious freedom.
I think you mentioned earlier you're engaging the subject of religious liberty. Could you speak to that? And also I'd be interested to hear you speak to maybe the trans issue as related to religious liberty for doctors and convictions they have about treating or not treating children or certain parties.
That's exactly the kind of thing that I am going to write about. Yeah, so I argue that actually the existence of heterodoxy Actually, let me take a step back. So, with respect to religious liberty or religious freedom, we could talk about, let's call religious liberty the freedom to practice your religion the way that you see fit. And we'll call religious freedom the freedom from the domination of some religion, right? And those are two different freedoms. And they often conflict. And in the United States, we've erred on the side of religious liberty, I think, rather than religious freedom, at least recently, in certain kinds of cases. So, for example, cases like the baker, right, who didn't want to do a gay wedding cake and didn't want to do a trans birthday cake. That kind of case, you know, there's kind of this general idea that, well, people should be able to do that. They should be able to, based on their religious beliefs, deny service. That's religious liberty. I want to argue that when something is the kind of thing that we would make a law against it without religious belief being a reason to do it, then religious belief shouldn't be a reason. In other words, I'm saying we should not have religious exceptionalism. We should, if you should have to serve anyone who comes into your place, then you should have to serve anyone, including somebody who's gay or somebody who's trans. Doctors should have to treat people who are trans, people who are gay. They shouldn't be able to claim that. Health insurance companies should have to give you all the kinds of health insurance that, you know, or, you know, the kinds of coverage that you might want, including like birth control, right? So I have my view about the relationship between the state and religion is quite different from the typical American view, whether you're talking about conservatives or even liberals. I think we have too much religious liberty, not enough religious freedom from the domination of religion. So I would sanction churches for being racist, for example. Churches that don't allow blacks in, I would sanction them. I would want to say, no, they should be sanctioned by the state. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. They should be, like, taken, their non-profit status should be taken away or something. Some kind of sanction. Not necessarily rounding them all up and shooting them, right? I mean, obviously, that's, like, an extreme way of solving that kind of problem. But a sanction, you know, soft sanctions. I think that's what we should do. So
same on the trans issue?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think... for example, the LDS Church should lose its nonprofit status. And
over its views on same-sex marriage and transgenderism?
Yeah. And maybe other things too, but at least those two. Yeah. I think that the public good trumps religious liberty. So, yeah. So the views that I have are probably not, wouldn't be very popular in your congregation or even in your audience, I would imagine. Because even liberals, when I talk about the views that I have about religious freedom, liberals even are typically kind of taken aback by it. To give you kind of a simplistic sense of how I would argue is, you know, someone might say, well, look, this is my Christian belief. I can't serve you, you know, I can't make a cake for you because this is my Christian belief. I want to say, okay, so you say it's your Christian belief, but actually it's your interpretation of Christianity, and there are plenty of Christians that don't interpret it that way. So it's not Christian per se, it's just your personal view. People like to, I think it's bad faith to say, I have to believe this because I'm Christian. No. People decide how to interpret Christianity, and there's so many different ways of interpreting it. And it's often the case that the ways of interpreting, say, the biblical passages that supposedly talk about homosexuality, it's often the case that the ways of interpreting those where they don't condemn homosexuality in general are the most, you know, most plausible ways of interpreting them. You know, talk to biblical scholars, serious biblical scholars at universities, they're going to say, yeah, you know, that Sodom and Gomorrah story has nothing to do with homosexuality, has nothing to do with sex even. It has to do with something else entirely, something way more abusive, you know, way...
Paul, what would be your view on Paul? Especially with respect to...
Well, I mean, my personal view on Paul is that there's some Paul stuff that's awful, right? And there's other Paul stuff that's good, but...
So it's treatment on gender and sexuality, yeah, and homosexuality.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were definite... there's a bias there, right? And I would interpret, like, say, the Romans passage as... Well, actually, you know, it's not obvious totally to me that... I don't know. It's something I would have to think more about. You have to understand, I'm not still trying to be a Christian, right?
Or interpret the text. Yeah. Yeah.
And even when I was a Mormon, I thought that Paul was wrong on... because Mormons don't have an inerrancy of the Bible. So I thought Paul was wrong about essentially the passages that you can interpret as Calvinist. Sorry.
I'm good.
The passages that you could interpret as Calvinist passages, that's where I thought he was wrong, exactly where I thought he was wrong. It seems to me that the Paul passages could be interpreted as being about something other than homosexuality. There's one Leviticus passage that, you know, that condemns homosexuality. And I think everybody's going to say, yeah, it does. But of course, that's a book that also condemns a whole bunch of other things that evangelicals don't care about. Right? Mixed clothing, shrimp, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, it's just one in a list of a whole bunch of things that Christians actually don't really care about, except for when it comes to, you know, homosexuality and trans people. Well, homosexuality in that case.
It does seem to be a distinction in Leviticus between expectations for the Mosaic community and expectations for the outsiders in the land of Canaan that were violated and which served as the ground for the conquest. So the rationale in Leviticus for certain ethics is specific to concerns for the Israelites.
Yeah. I'm sure there's ways that you have to respond to those interpretations, but I've read all of this stuff a long time ago, and I'm convinced that there's... I'm not convinced necessarily that I myself would want to adopt a particular interpretation of a particular text. What I am convinced of is this: there's always some way you can get around that, right? I mean, it's not Bible interpretation. It has a lot of flexibility in it. I think when Christians say Christianity means I have to be anti, you know, LGBTQ, that's bad faith. I don't believe that. And by bad faith, I mean, you're acting like it's Christianity that's telling you this. No. It's you that's telling Christianity this. You're interpreting it into the tradition.
In your view, perhaps those people ought to reconstruct their faith.
Yeah, come up with another interpretation. You can do it fairly easily, because I'm saying, you know, there's all these other ways of interpreting those kinds of passages.
Would the end result necessarily have to be faithful to what seems to be the most plausible original intent of the authors of the text?
Well, it's nice to try to get at that, but I mean, the best you can do is something like the Jesus seminar did.
I don't think many people... I know what that is, but I don't think people know what that is. So.
Yeah, the Jesus seminar, people actually tried to take a scientific approach to the New Testament. I think just the four Gospels, but it might be the whole New Testament.
Especially the Synoptics, maybe?
Yeah, the Synoptics. And figure out, essentially, what did Jesus really teach? And when you do that, you end up with a very kind of minimal core doctrine, and it's not what either conservative, you know, Protestants want or what Catholics want, even.
Remember a publication where there's color coding for different, or maybe like shades, mm-hmm. of overlay of different parts of the Synoptics, describing what the Jesus seminar scholars thought was likely faithful representation of what he said, and what was likely they thought made up. So they're kind of taking some a scalpel maybe and deciding what they thought was legitimate.
I mean, for me, as somebody who takes science as the ultimate arbiter, if you're going to try to figure out original intent, that's going to be about as close as you could possibly get. And even there, you're not going to get the original intent. Texts, the idea of getting at the original intent of a text is, it's transcendent. I'm a skeptic about the ability to do that. We read texts in terms of our lives. They're dynamic. They change. The interpretations of them change. There are things that no current Christian could understand about how Christians in the first century saw things, just because the world is so different, so fundamentally different. Our conceptual framework is different. Our way of thinking about things is different. We think about things in much more literalistic ways than they could have, because we've over time been affected by, you know, the tradition of philosophy, but also the development of science. All of that just changes our whole framework, right? So I think that attempting to find out what the original interpretation of a text is itself something that it's, you know, a fool's errand. You're not going to be able to do it. You're not going to be able to come down to one interpretation and make it so reasonable that everybody who's a reasonable participant in that discussion is going to agree that that's the right interpretation.
So the alternative to seeking original intent, say with Scripture or the Constitution, what interpretive mode or strategy do you suggest to the finding original intent?
I am not a believer in Scripture, so it's hard for me to answer that question.
Maybe law.
Yeah. Well, with law, I think it means whatever the court... In liberalism, it means whatever the courts say it does. I mean, it's however we interpret it now, that's what it means, right?
So the text in that case isn't authoritative, our interpretation of it?
No, it's authoritative in terms of... It's authoritative in terms of the language it has there and all of the prior rulings, precedents that have an effect on how we interpret that language.
This is kind of off topic, but I remember a paper, I think it was an Element by Nathan Oman, about a jurisprudence. A jurisprudential approach to nailing down Mormon doctrine.
I disagreed with Nate about almost everything, including that. With respect to the Constitution, you have to understand you're not talking to somebody who is in the normal part of the political discourse in the United States. I'm far enough left that I don't care about the Constitution. I want a new one. Totally new Constitution. Yeah.
What other topics would you like to close on? What's interesting to you?
This is about whatever you're interested in.
Yeah, okay.
Talked about a lot of stuff. So.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you dialoguing with me.
Or
sharing more. But I have some remaining questions that aren't in the flow of this. What should someone look at if they wanted to get a feel for the current scene of Mormon philosophy? And I know that you're not necessarily inside of that community anymore, but I know you've had a lot of background with it.
Yeah.
So if I wanted to have a better academic exposure to Mormon philosophy and modern expressions of it and sort of the landscape of it, and I ask this knowing that this isn't of necessarily like front burner interest to you anymore, but
I
it seems like you're
you
know a lot about
it.
Yeah.
So I would say in Mormon philosophy, I would read Adam S. Miller. He's the person to read.
One classic, Blake Osler.
No, I'm not interested in the stuff that he does. Although, you know, I mean, he did write a lot of stuff, and he might be of interest to people in the evangelical community because he does talk or he
interacts.
Yeah, he interacts. Yeah. Whereas I doubt Adam Miller does very much. Maybe Joseph Spencer too.
Okay.
He's a religion professor at BYU with a degree in philosophy. But in Mormon studies more broadly, I would say the most interesting books that have come out recently are a book by Taylor Petrie on the history of dealing with gender and sex in the LDS Church. It's called Tabernacles of Clay. I can't remember the publisher. It's either Oxford or Routledge or something. And then so Taylor Petrie, his book. Joanna Brooks has a book out about white supremacy in Mormonism. Mormonism and White Supremacy, I think, is what it's entitled. And it's a great book. It shows how deep white supremacist assumptions and systematic racism go in the Mormon tradition. And then there's another book. It was edited by Joanna Brooks and Gina Colvin, who's she's former LDS and is now a member of the Community of Christ. I don't know if you know them. Yeah, yeah. If I were to become a Mormon again, it would be that group. Okay. Right, yeah.
And they strike me as more like United Methodists today, the mainline denomination with people who don't necessarily agree with the fundamentals, the historic truth claims, but they're participating in a community that at least is connected to it.
Those narratives still mean something to them, but they don't think of the Book of Mormon as literally historical, but it means something to them in the same way that a lot of the narratives that they would also say in the Bible are not literal or historical. They're still important. Like, say, the Genesis story. That's a narrative, right? A lot of Christians don't believe that literally, right? A lot of Mormons do. A lot of evangelicals do. But a lot of Christians don't believe. Like, the United Church of Christ right over here, right? They're just a couple blocks over from here. It strikes me as pretty similar to the way the Community of Christ is in terms of how progressive they are and openness to various different interpretations. Anyway,
and historically, I know there's Eugene England. He was a helpful representative.
Yeah, he was good. He unfortunately died in 2002 or something, and that was when I took over as the Mormon Studies Coordinator at UBU. But yeah, I mean, he's a good person to read as somebody who is willing to raise problems but from a faithful point of view.
He wrestled.
Yeah, he wrestled with problems, but he was always more loyal to the church than he was to the problems. Yeah.
And then Sterling McMurrin?
Yeah, he was great. He was awesome, but that was a long time ago. Yeah. I mean, I would recommend reading his Theological Foundations of the Mormon Religion. If you want to get a kind of an overview of what Mormonism thinks, that's going to be the best place to start. Some people criticize his way of articulating it, but it's as good as any other from that time period. But that's old.
Who's prior to McMurrin? What philosophical LDS thinkers were active?
I would look at Orson Pratt.
Goes way back.
He has an essay called The Absurdities of Immaterialism, which is philosophically quite sophisticated for a 19th century, a 19th century amateur, actually.
Was it Talmadge, Roberts, and Widtsoe? Were they interesting to you?
Yeah, Roberts, especially. Yeah, and to some extent, Widtsoe and Talmadge, too, but Roberts more so. I was interested in his stuff.
And what works, we close with this, what works would be best representative of how you think today, or that would get at an approximation of where you're at?
That's a hard question. Yeah, I don't know. I would probably give some Buddhist philosophical texts and some Marxist philosophical texts. So Nagarjuna, I don't know which way it's pronounced, but he's a first century Buddhist philosopher who although I don't always agree with him, he's really interesting. Very compelling arguments. Predated Hume with Hume's kind of skepticism. I mean, long before Hume, he had the same kind of skepticism about the existence of the self and causation. I would say Nagarjuna. And then, Marx. Probably the German ideology, his piece to German ideology. I'm in the book on heterodoxy, I'm writing a chapter on Marxism and religion. It's on Engels. So I actually, more than Marx, I might recommend reading Engels on religion. The reason that I say that is because Engels was ambivalent. On the one hand, he was, like Marx, very critical of religious belief. But on the other hand, he also saw the revolutionary potential in it, and so he talked about that. It's almost like he was anticipating later liberation theology. So I like Engels' stuff a lot. I think he's kind of an underrated philosopher. And then there's a Russian philosopher that I really like named Evald Ilyenkov. I think that's how you pronounce it. I just read it in English because I don't read Russian. But he has a book called The Dialectics of the Ideal and another one on dialectical logic, both of which are really interesting to me. Some of the Soviet philosophy that happened after the death of Stalin, during the more open period that you get after, you know, with Nikita Khrushchev and so on, is really interesting. Some of that philosophy in that time period is really interesting. Yeah, I don't know how much of interest it would be to your audience.
But, I think good. Thank you for.
Yeah, yeah. Your name was Aaron.
Yeah, Aaron Shafawala.
Aaron Shafawala.